What does that sound like to you? That's Corky Siegel's latest CD, his chamber blues outfit. It's called Different Voices. I am very pleased to be in the studio with Fern Schumer Chapman and the genius. I should have had an adjective for you from the brilliant Fern Schumer Chapman and the genius illustrator designer Tom Greensfelder. They've done two books together. We'll talk about both of them, but we'll concentrate later in the show about Stumbling on History, an art project compels a small German town to face its past. Fern, when you were on talking about your previous books, it was one of the most, I don't want to say popular programs I've ever done, but moving, poignant, and generated dozens, if not hundreds, of emails. It's quite a story, is it not? Like finding my twin now in eighth grade class, reunited two Holocaust survivors. Tom also worked on that book, so tell me again, and tell the listeners again, it's one of the most haunting. It's Tom, don't you think? It's like an unbelievable story. It's like, no one, this couldn't happen.
No.
Fern, go ahead.
It happened.
Yeah. Yes, it did.
Well, I've been writing about returning to Germany for many years. It started with Motherland. After Motherland came out, a memoir that captured our return trips back to Germany in the
with
early
your
90s.
Mom. With your
my mom,
Edith, yeah.
I learned how she got here, and it was a very small program, an American program, organized by Lutherans, Quakers, and Jewish groups. And they brought over 10 kids at a time on cruise ships, 100 a year, between 1934 and 45. And I wrote a book called Is It Night or Day, which told the story of her childhood immigration. Part of that story was the friendship she made with a girl named Gerda Katz. Both girls had left everything behind. They were 12 years old. They had left their homeland and their school.
And their families.
And their family and their friends and were headed for America all by themselves. And, of course, these 10 kids broke off into pairs.
Of course.
And became best friends with somebody. Well, Edith, my mother, became best friends with Gerda Katz. And my mother took care of Gerda for most of the journey over the 10-day period because she became really seasick.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, without parents.
Well, it goes without saying, and Tom, this is something that you must be impressed. It is inconceivable to me how terrified these two little girls were or the faced with the unbelievable uncertainty of it all. And don't you think?
It's unimaginable. And I mean, the idea that at that age that you would be placed on a cruise ship, in this case it was the Deutschland, you know, this fancy cruise ship.
Yeah.
You're taken away from your family and sent across the ocean. And then you're given, two or three days off in New York?
I mean, right, a three-day tour of New York.
How the impression of New York coming from a small village in Germany, I can't even imagine.
I know, it's unimaginable.
Right.
Well,
but
everything
they
was
bonded, too, on that sojourn in New York, right?
Right, because once Gerda got off the ship, she wasn't seasick anymore.
I'm cured. It's a miracle. It's a miracle.
Right, and right. To speak to your point, everything was new. Window shades, water fountains, skyscrapers.
Right. And it went on from there, because then one of the things that stood out for me is they traveled after that on the 20th Century Limited,
right,
the
right.
fastest train
in the world
at that
the
time
in the
yeah.
world. They exchanged addresses. They knew where they were to go, and they were not going to the same city. So that must have been a kind of traumatic exchange of addresses.
My mother, Edith, knew where she would be going, but Gerda did not know the address. So my mother gave Gerda the address. Gerda took the Zephyr out to Seattle. And on that train, she lost Edith's address. And the two became as distant and as removed from one another as their families were in Germany. They lost touch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and the other thing, too, is, I mean, it's not only just distance, but it's almost time as well, because the village that Gerda came from and Edith, these were almost like medieval villages.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Small villages in Germany hadn't changed much from, you know, 17th century, really. So, or further back, even.
Yeah. And then?
And so in recent years, I have visited many, many schools, including Madison Junior High School in Naperville. And I give speeches about my mother's childhood immigration story. This particular school had read Is It Night or Day, the mm-hmm. book about her childhood immigration. And after my presentation, one of the girls stood up and said, "What happened to Gerda Katz?"
Wow.
And I didn't know what to say. I said, "I don't really know." And I tried to look, but I hadn't looked very hard. Well, I left the school without giving it a whole lot of thought. And then 3 months later, when I was traveling in Boston, my mother left messages for me everywhere to please call. And when I finally called her at the end of a really busy day, she can barely talk. She's paralyzed. Mm. And I said, "Did something happen?" And the only thing she could say was the word Gerda. And I said, "Did you hear from her?" And she said, "Yes." Yeah. And it turned out that class had decided to make it a service learning project to locate and reunite these two old friends.
Aye.
And they were reunited in Seattle in 2011, 73 years after they had last seen each other.
It is a story that, Tom, I speak for you too, that literally takes your breath away.
Yeah. I mean, when I've given samples of the book to friends, I mean, people just tell me, I mean, it's like they were crying at the end of the book, really, because it's just such a moving story. It had such a wonderful, I mean, for an outcome from such horrible events to have something that, I mean, it's beyond
it's
closure.
It's triumphant, and it's also, to me, it's such a life-affirming story.
Exactly.
Especially because of the involvement of the kids.
Right.
You got to take a little break. I'm in here with the brilliant writer Fern Schumer Chapman and the genius illustrator designer Tom Greensfelder. We may talk a little bit more about that story, but we're talking about their second collaborative effort. I think Tom is in here because I was raving so vociferously about his work on that first book. So I'll tell you this and stay tuned. There's a new team coming to town, the WGN TV Evening News team at 4. Join Ben Bradley, Lourdes Duarte, Demetrius Ivory, and Jared Payton. Weekdays at 4 starting April 4th on WGN TV. That is, if you can't tell, the sort of the definition of chamber blues. That's Corky Siegel's Chamber Blues latest CD, Different Voices. I'm in here with Fern Schumer Chaplin, an illustrator. I've stopped using the adjectives because you've heard them all before. The illustrator, yes. Tom Greensfelder, who first collaborated on Fern's book, like Finding My Twin, How an English Eighth Grade Class Reunited Two Holocaust Refugees After Some 73 Years, one of them being Fern's mother, who lost track of the little girl she came to America with at 12 on a boat and a train and a couple of fun days in Manhattan. How did you find Fern? Because I remember complimenting that book, not just for the writing, but for the design and the graphic pizzazz of it. How did you find Tom?
Well, when I recognized that publishing is changing so much and I was having problems getting any of the traditional publishers interested in this particular work, a friend of mine recommended Tom to me. And he's a Chicago designer, and I liked the idea that I could actually sit down with him and look at the work.
Yeah.
And I actually have discovered that I like this a whole lot better.
There's no question. There's no question.
The other,
you know, in traditional publishing as it existed up until about 10 years ago, it was like you felt like a cog in a machine that didn't, you know, give 2 cents about you or what you thought a book should look like or what you felt a book should look like. Tom, did this immediately appeal to you? How did you say, "Hey, I've got a great story, and here it is"?
Yeah, in a way, it's the kind of design I've been wanting to do for quite a while. I have done similar design in the past, but for example, when I first moved to Chicago to work for a newspaper In These Times, and
oh God, I loved In These Times.
Yeah, so I was there for 2 or 3 years, and I was assistant art director, and then within 6 months, I became the art director. And that combination of adding text, adding compelling stories to images, to me is just what design is about.
Sure.
And after that, I designed the alumni magazine for the University of Chicago for a number of years. That gave me a similar opportunity. But since then, it's really been kind of a long, dry spell for that kind of design for me.
Yeah.
And with the arrival of print-on-demand, I've had the opportunity to design books now, which were impossible before because I didn't have an association with an actual publisher. So individuals would approach me. And in fact, one of the first books I designed print-on-demand was another Holocaust memoir. But it was a different book. It was all text.
Sure.
And
sure,
there were some photographs, but they were at the end. So what Fern brought was an opportunity because she'd already published the story.
Right.
But was a way of telling the story both with words but also visually. And so the level of, I guess you'd say, almost counterpoint on a page-by-page basis where they work with each other.
Exactly.
Is to me what makes this project so great.
Well, and it also, what you've done with what you did with that book and have done with Stumbling on History is make them, they need to be, and this is a weird word to say in terms of what the subjects are about, they need to be visually exciting.
Indeed, I think so. And also, I think the historical artifacts themselves tell a story. And to see them in the context of this particular story gives them an extra resonance. We've all seen pictures of Nazis before. We've seen pictures of cruise ships before. But
sure,
the way they work out in this particular story, how they provide, I don't know how to say it exactly, but it propels the story. I mean, each—
No question.
This is—
There is a— I mean, I don't know much about design. I know what I like, as they say.
Right.
But there is a narrative drive to the design both of these books.
Yeah.
And that's purposeful. That wasn't a happy accident.
No.
I just want to say one quick thing, jump in here and say that my goal in any of the books I write is to give the reader the experience that they wouldn't have unless I exposed them to it. So these two books, which bring them to two very important events, one is obviously this ceremony for Stumbling on History, and the other is what these students did in the reunion of the two old friends. I want you to feel like you're there, and I think I needed the visuals to give the reader that experience.
And that was the other thing. We were very lucky to have these events documented, like when the children in the high school in Twin find out that they have discovered, or when the Gerda and Edith come to meet with the kids. That's so incredible that you actually get to see the expressions on the kids' face. And again, in Stumbling on History, to see this German town, these people, where these events have happened, and it's a small town.
Yeah.
They all know each other, and many stood by while these terrible things happened, and this is a chance for them to kind of, well, as Fern points out, it's a kind of atonement, and it's a struggle. You can see it in their faces, but...
Well, as we all know, I mean, anyone who has read about or studied the Holocaust, I am no student of the Holocaust, but I've certainly spent some time studying it, that the whole notion of the desire to forget is not just, I think, inherent in Holocaust survivors, many of whom, as you well know, Fern Barton, and probably anybody, just don't like to talk about it. They don't like to revisit that time. And in that same way, German citizens who... You know, we're not working in the camps. We're simply alive. are also reluctant. One of the things, the thing that seems to compel stumbling on history, an art project compels a small German town to face its past, is that overriding question of who will remember.
Right. And I think, to go to in a way, I think that we also should point out the true genius of the artist who created this project.
Oh, yeah, I want to talk about this guy.
Because I think that, too, is a very interesting story. You know, I mean, because this wasn't his first project in this sort of way, but in what he's done is so powerful that some cities won't permit these stones to be placed.
I know. We got a few minutes here. His name is Günter Demning.
That's right.
How did he come up with this idea? Well, first of all, for what is the idea? What was his idea? It's not a thousand cities. It's one of the largest art projects I've ever encountered.
I think so. Yeah.
His idea was to memorialize the victims of the Holocaust, and that includes those who were murdered, those who resisted, those who were dislocated or displaced. And his idea was that you walk past these plaques all the time and you don't read them and you don't notice them. So he wanted to embed the plaques in the center of the walkway. And his idea was you would not only stumble with your feet, but also with your head and your heart. And so his idea was that he would install these stones, and here's where the controversial part comes in front of the former homes of the Jewish residents.
Yeah.
And the reason this is so controversial is, unlike here where houses are handed down, houses are sold when you move, in Germany houses are handed down generation
sure.
after generation.
Sure.
And so the house becomes very closely aligned with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, if you're putting stones in front of the Jewish homes, you're basically placing an arrow at who the Nazis were. And they tried to shroud their history, their family history, in secrecy.
Well, but the other thing is there are no, as everyone should know, there are no burial sites. And that's the other. There is no, you know, there's no Arlington National Cemetery.
That is such an important point. And one of the things that people don't realize is those who were murdered have not been had a funeral.
Right.
Have not had a burial site. There's no place of remembrance. And the problem with that is people like my mother cannot fully grieve because they haven't had what most civilized society offers, which is an opportunity to bury your loved ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't go to Auschwitz and say, "Where's a plaque for my grandfather?"
Right.
For God's sake.
Right.
So the ceremonies themselves, where they install these plaques in front of the Jewish homes, become the actual funeral service.
Sure.
For
sure.
People like my mother.
And you went to one of these,
right.
And you. Tom had been to the very town.
Yes.
We got to take a commercial break and to get the. No, we have no commercial break because Tom Hush, the new producer, is a genius here. He's told all the commercial people, no, we don't sell ads anymore. We got to get some news. We'll come back and talk more about this remarkable book and this artist. And I just, in the minute we have left, he must have gotten unbelievable pushback. Certainly at the beginning of this.
Every town council has to approve of this.
Ay, wow.
And the mayor actually proposed it in Stuttgart, my mom's town.
Yeah.
And he expected tremendous opposition. Not one voice was raised
against
him. That's
amazing. And you and your mom went there to see that happen. Yeah. We'll be back with Fern Schumer Chapman and Tom Greensfelder after a little break. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. One night I devote the entire show to Corky Siegel when he's not on the road and will come in here. That's his latest CD by his amazing group Chamber Blues. It's called Different Voices. Fern Schumer Chapman, an illustrator, writer Fern Schumer Chapman, an illustrator, designer Tom Greensfelder. Their second book is Stumbling on History. It's about this art project that places plaques in thousands of cities to commemorate the lives of people who died in the Holocaust, not all at concentration camps, but who died in the Holocaust.
Or were forced to flee.
Or were, exactly, who were forced to flee. This artist is incredibly cool to me.
Yes.
The artist, but yeah. He's obsessive. This is a mission that very few artists I know would take on because he does the work himself, right?
Yes. Right. He handcrafts all of the plaques, and the idea is he's installed 50,000 stones throughout Europe, former Nazi-occupied countries. And the idea is that he wants to give the tenderness and humanity that he can in opposition to the way the Nazis committed genocide.
What compelled him? Did he lose people?
No, I don't think he did. I think that it's important to recognize that there is a legacy to any of these genocides. And we see it to some extent in our country, and it's become quite topical.
Sure.
That what is the responsibility of people today to the past? And his interest in all this started years ago, and the reason was that he was tracing the chalk lines in Cologne to show – it was an artist, activist artist project mm-hmm. – to show how they had fled, the gypsies had fled Cologne during the Nazi era. And as he was doing this, one of the neighbor lady comes out of the apartment, and she's elderly, and she says, "What are you doing?" And he tells her, and she says, "But there were never any gypsies here." And he was so upset by that that he decided he needed to do something that was more closely tied to the place where people lived.
And I think earlier you mentioned, you know, there is no graveyard for the people who died.
Yeah, no
in the
burial site.
In fact, this is much better in a way because in a graveyard, it would be somewhere outside the city or
– Oh, yeah.
Well, many of the Jewish graveyards anywhere are neglected because there's nobody to take care
of
them. But exactly. These are placed exactly where they lived. So you know that
– And also to the point that the maintenance of them is minimal, on like a tombstone or a grave site.
Right.
What do you, as a visual artist, think of this as an art project?
Well, it's an incredibly engaged piece of work, and I think that's almost a separate category within the art world. I mean, so much of the art world, it's about galleries, it's about museums, it's about a certain level of critical recognition. This work exists without any of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't need it. It doesn't require it. And yet it's incredibly powerful work.
This book, Stumbling on History, can be had at Amazon. The easiest way to go about it is Amazon.com because Amazon's taking over the world. And you should get the Chapman-Greensfelder duet, the Finding My Twin. If you just look up, you can find it. If people are smart enough to get to Amazon, you'll find it. Right. Fern Schumer Chapman, Chapman. This book is also, Tom, if I hadn't said it, it's very moving, Fern. And when you and your mom go back to that little town, the photos are great, and you can feel it. You can sense it. What's next for you two? You can't stop this collaboration.
I don't want
this to be like Martin and Lewis.
There you go. You know? Maybe not quite that bad.
Do you have another project in mind?
I do have another project in mind, and Tom and I have been aware of this story for a long time.
Well, in fact, we took it out of the first book.
We did.
Really?
Yeah.
We edited that page out because we decided that it deserved its own work.
Right.
And so my mother's friend was Gerda Katz, and Gerda's family actually escaped Nazi Germany, which is very unusual.
No kidding.
And the way they escaped is that there was a dictator in the Dominican Republic named Rafael Trujillo.
Sure.
And he had massacred 25,000 Haitians and had a terrible image in the world and decided that while all the other countries around the world found excuses not to take in the hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees, he would in fact take in Jewish refugees. And what he provided was a little homesteading.
Well, but the reason why is quite fascinating, because Trujillo, you know, wore heavy pancake makeup in order to make himself look more white. And he felt that the Dominicans were too dark, and that by bringing in European Jews, he would be able to, you know, basically lighten his people.
Well, you knew there had to be some non-altruistic aspect to this.
Yes, of course.
And they went there.
They went there and they intermarried. And so these people who were persecuted for their religion in Germany were prized for the color of their skin in the Dominican Republic.
That is a fascinating story.
There are remnants of the Jewish community, and there are actually some people who did do exactly what Trujillo had dreamed of. And so they still remain there. Gerda Katz's family was one of the families that lived in the Dominican Republic. Now, the interesting part about it is they couldn't get
out. Well, actually, what you've just told me is fascinating. Yes. So now we're down to just interesting. Yeah.
No, it's just one of those historical moments.
Gerda was in Seattle. Her parents were in the Dominican Republic. There is a correspondence and a photographic archive of all of these experiences. And so we are going to draw on the letters between Gerda and her family, as well as the photographs from Germany, the Dominican Republic, and Seattle. And we will put together another book just like this.
All right.
Because they were separated for 10 years.
Right? I'm penciling you in for whenever you want to come back on the show and
we'll
talk about this.
Sure, anytime.
You two are quite a team. You two really are.
What I wanted to say is Gerda didn't see her parents for 30 years.
Oh, 30 years.
Because the Dominican Republic wouldn't let her family out.
Oh, God. Wow.
Wow.
Can't wait to read that.
Yeah.
Fern Schumer Chapman, you always amaze me. And Tom Grinsfelder, I knew you were a genius when I saw that first book, and you continue that amazing work in Stumbling on History. Thank you both for coming in. Now go get to work on that third book.
Thanks, sir. It's always great to be here.
It's always great. The ongoing story, Fern, that your life has become is fascinating on every single level, and you found a good artistic creative match in Tom. Tom, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
Take a little break and talk about the Everly sisters when we come back. The changing gears.
There is nothing that is wrong wanting you to stay here with me.
That, ladies and gentlemen, from Corky Siegel's latest CD. This is the world premiere, Corky Siegel's Chamber Blues. The CD is called Different Voices. It's now my great pleasure to have on by phone a young lady named Amelia Bethel, who is part of the drinking and writing crew. Those of you who've listened to the show over the years have heard the drinking and writing boys 348 times on this program. Amelia, it's a pleasure to talk to a female voice.
Hi, Rick. I'm so happy to be talking to you. Thanks for having me.
You guys had a benefit today, didn't you? How'd it go?
It was so much fun. We had a really great time. We had a lot of good music, a lot of fun performance art. We did a little sneak peek. We had a grand time, and we're really excited for next Saturday to open.
Well, next Saturday you open. Is the name of the show Feminism and Other Things, or is that the name of the benefit you just had?
That is the name of the show. The name of the benefit was Feminism and Other Things, the fundraiser. So, you know, we like to be straightforward.
What a difference. Okay, how did you get involved with these lovely characters? Have you been involved with the drinking and writing gang for a long time?
It's been a while now. It's been about a year. They posted an audition notice, and I liked the sound of it. I like writing. I like drinking. And I submitted, and they liked what I did, and we got along great. And it's been a little over a year now that we've been hanging out and making art together.
Well, I find the two guys, Steve and Sean, to be so wonderfully, playfully creative. Is that a good way to describe them now that you're working with them so intimately?
That is a really wonderful way to describe them, yeah. And it really, you know, gives the rest of us a lot of room to move around and play and be creative in ways that, you know, you don't always have the opportunity to be in other settings. So I've really appreciated getting to know them and getting to learn from them.
So now you, it's my understanding, you co-created this show, did you not? You're one of two writers and performers and creators of the new show. They must trust you a great deal, Amelia. Those guys must trust you a great deal. How did the show, what's the seed of the show then? And who's your co-writer, co-creator?
Yes, me and Lady Grace are creating it. I believe you spoke to her last year when they did the Love Show in April of 2016. She misses you. She says hello.
Well, that could be. Get on the phone, too. That could well be, but you know Steve and Sean, they really hog the microphone. So, Lady Grace, if I don't remember exactly what you said, you know exactly what I mean. Okay, what's the seed of the show? I mean, you guys obviously said, hey, we want to do a show in the drinking and writing portion of this thing.
We were really interested in doing a full length, you know, because we do the monthly show versus where you get the opportunity to write shorter plays every month or every week or so. But we were really interested in writing a full length show. And, you know, the way the world is right now, it seems like we shouldn't have to fight so hard to have female voices and voices that aren't white and male and straight. And we wanted to include those voices in the artistic conversation.
Give me a rough, if you would, Amelia, give me a rough notion of the narrative arc of the show. I mean, I know so very little about it. And all the drinking and writing shows are based on, loosely on, writers who drink sometimes to excess. Mm-hmm. But your show, what I know about it, is it's featuring the two of my favorite Chicago historical figures, those business entrepreneurs, Mina and Ada Everly, who ran a house of pleasure near 22nd and Wabash.
They sure did.
Yeah, they're fascinating.
Yeah, we're.
Go ahead.
They're
go
fascinating
ahead.
Characters. Yeah, we discovered them actually right before we started writing it, and I just thought it was a nice little narrative arc to include, you know, their story from when they moved to Chicago, opened this house of pleasure, as you said. Uh-huh. They were really the toast of the town for about a decade until they got shut down. And it's just such a fun story, you know. It's very interesting to hear about these two madams who were not only interested in making money, but also in a way uplifting the women who worked for them. You know, they let their employees have boyfriends. They let them quit to get married or get better jobs. They taught them Latin. They taught them the
music
from Balzac. They taught them dance and music. Yeah.
See, I think you're so on to something here in that the not only was the Everly Club the most famous brothel in the world at the time, it is arguably the most cultured brothel in the history of that business enterprise. They would have readings and concerts and all sorts of things, and they had, as far as I know, I certainly wasn't around then, but you know, the reporters for the 8 newspapers used to get considerable discounts when they would patronize that place. So the environment itself is just nurturing for the arts, Drew.
I would agree. And, you know, they really made a point of hiring some of the best musicians to fill their dance halls and their parlor, play their gold piano. That's one of my favorite parts, the fact that they decided to invest in a gold piano. I mean, how fun. They were very interesting arts. And they did teach these women, you know, there's a great story about when they hosted, I believe it was Prince Henry from Prussia. They not only decided that they were going to, you know, dress everyone up real fancy, they also taught them a dance that was like loosely based on the Bacchanalia, included ballet where they were like wearing and eating like pieces of raw meat and like using the like whole space as their dance floor. And I mean, you know, that's something that, like, I'd like to see someone do a dance with raw meat now. I'd watch that.
Of course. Of course. Who wouldn't? So you use, yeah. do you use the, Amelia, do you use the Everly Club as a kind of foundation and intersperse other stories, whether of yours or Lady Grace's or takes from women writer drinkers?
Yes, we do. So, yeah, we use them as sort of a through line to mm-hmm. ground the stories that Grace and I decide to tell. You know, so we use they're coming to Chicago. Grace and I are both from elsewhere, both from California. So we wanted to, you know, include our stories coming to Chicago and what drew us here, what's keeping us here, and also the unique struggles that we face as women in this industry and in this world right now. We each have specific theses so far, specifically, what does it mean to be a 21st century woman, and how, in a world like we live in, does one reconcile their identity with their desire? You can't always wow. do those things so very easily. Yeah.
Wow. Now, when's the show open?
It opens April 1st, so this coming Saturday at 4 p.m.
And run? What's the run?
We are running the month of April, Tuesdays at 7:30 and Saturdays at 4. No show on April 18th. But otherwise, we're going to be at the Drinking and Writing Theater every Tuesday night and every Saturday afternoon.
Which is
really excited.
Which is in the carved from the back of a great place called the Haymarket.
Yes.
At Randolph and Halsted, which used to be a place, as you well know, called Barney's Market Club, which seems like something out of the Everly Sisters era, where its slogan was, "Hello,
like
Senator,"
it.
Because the guy who owned it couldn't remember anybody's name. You two must be very. You must be. Is Steve directing this, or are you two doing it all on your own? What are Steve and Sean involved? What's their involvement?
Steve is directing us. Sean is a great cheerleader for us, but Steve is directing us. And yeah, he's helped us really guide the script into a place where we're really overjoyed to present the script that we've created over the last few months. And yeah, helping us out when we need another set of eyes to see what's where and how we're moving in relation to each other. So he's been a really great asset.
And you and Lady great Grace help. Are you in any anxiety? Or are you eager to get it up on stage? Did you give a little preview tonight at the benefit?
We did. We did a little sneak peek tonight. I'm not going to, you know, you can come see the show if you
sure.
want to know what the sneak peek was. It's going to be included in the show. But yeah, we had so much fun actually getting at least a part of it on its feet in front of people who hadn't seen it before. So I know that we're both even more excited than we already were after today.
Well, I just think it's great that Steve and Sean have sort of opened the gates to female performers so forcefully, dramatically,
yeah.
and what I think is very provocatively, too. I think the whole Everly sister idea, it's provocative on the face of it, I think. The Everly sisters as a kind of framework for this. Can you tell me what, if any, female writer drinkers might be featured in this show, like famous ones?
We do discuss Lorraine Hansberry a bit.
Oh, okay, sure.
She, you know, is such a wonderful voice.
Yep.
And she has a really great passage about Chicago that we included in our piece. And that is one of the only, like, explicit
sure.
Chicago female drinker
sure.
writers. We really decided to use this opportunity to discuss a lot of issues that are facing us and facing probably a lot of other women, and to hopefully open up a discussion between ourselves and between other female or otherwise, you know, non-male identifying artists within the community.
Well, Amelia Bethel, that's what theater should be all about. Go to drinkingandwriting.com for all the details and to get tickets. I will come see this one. They honored me years ago.
Thank you. We're really,
now,
we're really
this sounds really, really provocative. And please say hello to Lady Grace and tell her.
I would. Do you want to say hello right now?
Hello, Lady Grace. How are you?
Oh.
Good. Knock 'em dead, ladies. Knock 'em dead. That's all I can tell you. I'll see you soon. Thanks for coming on. Thanks.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Anytime. That show does sound incredibly provocative. You've heard the drinking and writing guys on here a number of times. You'll hear some music after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. It's 10 o'clock, and here with the news brought to you by College Illinois Prepaid Tuition Program is my pal Roger Badish.
All the night's magic seems to whisper and hush,
and all the soft moonlight seems to shine.
It must have been moon glow, way up in the blue. Must have been moon.
Just listen to that, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Listening to that, I will tell you that I have your every Saturday night for the month of April already planned. That would be the 1st, the 8th, the 15th, the 22nd, and the 29th to hear those two people, Becky Menzie and Tom Michael, do, and thanks for coming on, you two. I cannot believe that this cannot be the 18th show you've done at Davenport's, is it?
The 18th year, and yes, 18th annual show at Davenport's, and every year it's a new show.
Well, you guys
are getting older.
Well, who isn't? Yeah, but you guys are just getting better. Just getting
Thank
better.
You.
This one sounds as provocative as any that you've done. The highs and lows of musical duos. Before we discuss who the duos are, what's the seed of this? Did you at one point say to yourselves, God, that Sonny and Cher must have had a really interesting life or something?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, we did a show about 10 years ago called Better Together, T-W-O.
Right. You did a CD.
And, yeah, we did. Yeah. And this show, we started talking this last year about, you know, we want to explore further duos, but be more specific and narrow it down to just a couple of duos and really explore why some duos lasted the test of time and why others didn't. And then, of course, toward the end of the show, we bring it back to us and, you know, how we continue to our friendship and our duo being a duo together.
Don't give away all of our secrets.
Well, yeah, we just want to intrigue the audience enough to go there. Let me talk about the two of you. Okay. How did the two of you, do you remember the first time you heard or set eyes on one another?
Oh, yeah. We actually talk about that. Becky, you want to?
Tom had seen me play for an open mic at Boombala. I came into town. I loved Boombala.
Oh, that's such fond memories, Becky.
You were my first quote ever for the Addams Family Band at the Boombala Fest. Tommy came in there, and then he hired me for a session, which he wanted me to transpose up a tritone for the entire hour. And when it was done, I thought, because I was organic and he was a different musician from me, and I thought, I don't know if I have to see this person again.
Now, this was 28 years ago, mind you. So
wow.
We've come a long way since then.
Wow.
Well, maybe. You know, Rick, when the idea actually happened, we were in two separate cars talking on our phones.
Oh, that's right. That's
on Bluetooth.
Right.
And my fiance was saying, my fiance is Julian Frazen's brother-in-law.
Sure.
And he was saying,
Julian Frazen, the great lyricist, lyricist. Yeah. Go ahead, Becky. I'm sorry.
You're fine, dear. And he said, he was going, Loggins and Messina, they had this great breakup, and we started talking about the ins and outs and the competition between duos like Simon and Garfunkel, and then we called Tommy, and we all, between four people and two phones on Bluetooth going to Michigan, we actually
conceptualized this kind of show. I guess the most famous song breakup is, apart from the Beatles, I guess, is Simon and Garfunkel. Is that true, or do I not know enough?
No, I mean, I think they're fascinating.
Yeah.
I find them because when you, I went back and read about every breakup and every fight, and friendship plays a factor in Simon and Garfunkel and expectations.
Sure. And also, those are two guys who started very, very young together.
Yeah, they were kids together.
Yeah.
You know?
And I guess, you know, success, you know, can play wicked, wicked, wicked head games on people. So is it during the, you're obviously going to perform the music of people like Simon and Garfunkel and Steve and Edie, as you say. I'm not trying to give too much away. And also the Carpenters. Will that be interspersed with you know, the details of the lives of these duos?
Oh, yeah. We tell a lot of stories about these groups and, you know, how they met, how about their journey together, about why some of them stayed together. Like Steve and Edie were together for 55 years, as, you know, not only husband and wife, but as music partners.
Sure.
And, I mean, their relationship was, it couldn't be any better as far as, you know, to a duo. You know, I mean, they lasted the test of time, and we talk about that. But they certainly had their lows, too. You know, it wasn't about breaking up, but it was about the death of their son, and we go into that a little bit. And, you know, there's, so we talk about the highs of their relationship as well as the lows. And, you know,
Tom dishes the dirt. That's just what he does. He dishes the dirt.
Did you come up, I mean, in your research, were there any great... Well, we got to take a break.
Okay.
If you can stay on for a couple more minutes, we'll talk a little more about the show, and then I want to play an entire song of the two of you singing so that people who don't know Becky Menzie and Tom Michael will get a real sound. I think just the way you two sing together is a revelation.
Thank you.
My pleasure. You've known I've felt that way forever. Get the stories that make the city with unlimited digital access to award-winning Chicago Tribune News. Become a member today at chicagotribune.com. Your Saturday nights in April are spoken for April 1st, 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th at 8 o'clock. You should be at Davenport's to hear two of the greatest performers in the history of Chicago, Becky Menzie and Tom Michael. They are a duo, and they are doing a show devoted to the highs and lows of other lesser musical duos, such as Simon and Garfunkel, Steve and Edie, the Carpenters, Fred and Adele Astaire. Fred and Adele Astaire, one fascinating group. What has kept you two? You are two of the most creative people I know. Also, two of the... It may just be that you're both so nice, and that's why you never broke up. But what is it about... You know, it's my theory in music, especially jazz and cabaret, that no one ever sings or plays a song the same way twice. So there is this sort of inherent growth to the whole thing. Is that part of the secret to you two?
I think it's a mixture of those two things. We still rehearse. We have had for 18 years. 2 to 3 times a week. We're always learning new material. We always do a debut, a new show, and sometimes they tour to concert halls around the country, and sometimes they die a slow, painful death. But I think it's that we constantly are trying new opportunities. We've been singing with some orchestras with holiday shows. We did that big Cole Porter event last year with several different artists in town.
Oh, right, right, right.
And the Rich Daniels Big Band. So... I think it's a mixture of we're not getting bored or lazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And we actually like each other.
Yeah. Well, to see the two of you perform, that sense of affection is absolutely palpable. Did you, either of you two, before I let you go, and thanks for doing this again, and go to davenportspianobar.com or go to Becky, that's B-E-C-K-I-E, Menzie, M-E-N-Z-I-E.com, or Tom Michael, and I'm not going to insult you by spelling that for you. It's Tom Michael. Tom Michael.
It.
If you don't, if your people it. Can't get that, then you're in big trouble. You shouldn't be listening to the station. were there any real revelations, either happy or sad, in your research for this musical duo's show?
You want me, Tam, or you?
Either one.
Let me think. You go ahead, Beck.
Well, for me, the biggest revelation is that I found it very sad that you would read an article that Art Garfunkel might say, I genuinely loved Paul Simon, and he was really important to me. And then you'd need to read another article where he calls him a monster. And, you know, I don't think that neither Paul Simon nor Art Garfunkel were tenders of relationships, gardeners. And I would say that Tom Michael is a gardener of a friendship and a business partnership. And so I think that might be the difference, is that we both have a little bit of gardener of our relationships in us. And I don't think that the gentlemen, who were incredibly talented, and I do believe really care, they grew up three blocks from each
other. Yeah.
So for me, that was the saddest realization, was checking out, you know, learning, reading the really disgusting things. The most disgusting thing I could say about Tom is that he leaves the toilet seat up in my house.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you just said that on air. Okay. I think that we were rehearsing with our director a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, the two of you really are kind of the perfect combination of Stevie Nicks and Simon and Garfunkel. If these two met in the middle, that's kind of where you guys are.
Yeah.
And I never thought of that, but he was right, because I thought there's no accident that we chose these particular duos to really focus on with this show. And I think it is because we kind of are right smack dab in the middle of those two artists.
Well, you were sounding to me better than ever, and I think the fact that you're continually growing and continually trying new things and taking,
you know, ultimately, Rick, it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah,
to do this.
Yeah,
it's really a lot of fun to do this.
When you people who have never seen these two together, you don't know what fun is until you have seen these two together. They know how to work a room. You will become. Not since Buddy Charles have I seen people work a room the way you two work a room.
That's a really nice compliment.
Well, it's really my pleasure. This show sounds so intriguing. I got to get up there. The highs and lows of musical duos, starring Becky Menzie and Tom Michael at Davenport's every Saturday at 8 o'clock, the entire month of April, before they move this show on to bigger and better things, although Davenport's is pretty big and it doesn't get much better. You two, what lovely people. Onward. Carry on.
We adore you.
I adore you, too. You've given me a lot of pleasure over the years. Now, ladies and gentlemen, listen to them do what they do.
Chicago, that toddling town.
It's our hometown.
Chicago, I'll show you around.
You'll love it.
Bet your bottom dollar you will lose the blues in Chicago. The folks who visit all wanna settle down. On State Street, that great street, I just wanna say, they do things they don't do on Broadway. Say, you'll have the time of your life. Bring all your friends, your kids, and your wife to Chicago. It's our hometown. Home for the holidays. I believe I've missed each and every face. Come on and play one easy. Let's turn on every love light in the place.
It's time I find myself totally surrounded in your circles. Oh, my friends,
please celebrate me home. Give me a number myself to all alone, I can sing me home.
Loving you the way I do, I only want to be with you, and I would go to the ends of the earth, 'cause darling, to me that's what you're worth.
If you're out on the road feeling lonely and so cold, all you gotta do is call my name and I'll be there on the next train.
Where you lead, I will follow.
Seating my chair here to, you all know Elif Garris is the producer of this show for about the last year, but then she, a couple weeks ago, moved over to a, like, a real job, and producing John Williams, who's on from 1 to 3 every day, and also on Saturdays in Kathy and Judy's old spot. She had introduced me to a band called Mole Hill, which you can find and discover beyond what you hear today at molehillmusic.com. Her instincts are right. This is a great band. Elif, thanks for introducing me to Mole Hill. Three of Mole Hill's people are in here. It's your show.
Okay.
Well, let me first ask you, how did you get introduced to this band?
I think what happened was Trevor emailed the radio station where I used to work at UIC, and I think that was how I discovered them. And I said, well, it's a local band, and I liked their music. So I said, come on in, let's do an interview. And I was really young. It was really cool to keep experiencing new music.
Well, good. Now that you're not so young,
yeah,
find out more about these guys.
So I've talked to a couple of you before, but it's nice to catch up sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you introduce yourselves one by one?
I am Peter Manhart. I am the lead singer and the guitar player for Mole Hill.
I am Trevor Jones. I play bass and sing backup vocals.
My name is Greg Van Zuden. I play keyboards and I also sing backup vocals.
What do you love most about what you do with music?
Just having an outlet to create, basically, just to be able to express ourselves, creatively, and not be beholden to anybody else, and be able to really do what we want.
I have nothing to add to that. That's exactly the same.
It's a perfect philosophy.
How do you think your fans? How do you think that they experience your music?
That depends. I think if they come to a live show, it's definitely different. Any artist that you listen to and you kind of like a song, and then you go see them live, you get to see the full personality on stage. And we definitely, you know, we've played like 300 plus shows at this point as a live band. So I think that's the way to see us if you can.
Well, and I think also you as artists yourselves and people who are expected to give off the stage presence, a strong stage presence, you're also introducing yourself to your listeners, or your fans rather, and you get to see their ways of taking in your music. And actually, Trevor, I interviewed you a little bit ago, for a different reason, but you told me that there are some fans who are really shy, and you can tell because...
Yeah, sometimes when you look out from the stage, you look at somebody and you don't know if they're necessarily, like, really enjoying the music, and then after the show they can come up to you and, you know, talk to you, like, for 5 or 10 minutes and tell you about a song or a moment in the show or something that really meant a lot to them. And that's not sometimes always apparent when you're on stage. And they're just actually, they're focusing really hard on what's happening. And that doesn't necessarily translate sometimes when you're looking at them from the stage.
Elif, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
Where are you guys from and how did you get together?
I am originally from the north suburbs, Libertyville. Trevor here is from Gettysburg, and I had a band by the same name, Molehill, years ago, which was basically a completely different band. And one guy that was playing bass in the band for a while is a guy that I knew from high school, and he was in the graduate program for upright bass performance at DePaul. He was in that program with Trevor, and he introduced – Trevor had recently moved to Chicago from – I think – were you in – where were you before this? In Philadelphia? Or
West Virginia.
Oh, you were in West Virginia.
I just like the whole Gettysburg thing, man. I think you should just be from Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's even more exotic than being from Vegas.
Yeah. We stop at Gettysburg quite often when we're touring on the East Coast.
Yeah, to see my folks, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. They always treat us really well. And then Greg came along. Again, it was kind of a weird word-of-mouth thing. It was another guy that had been in the band for a little while playing keyboard. He knew Greg in college, and when Greg graduated, I actually got this pretty funny email one time. Hi, my name's Greg Van Zuten. I just graduated. I don't really know what I want to do with my life, but I studied music. I was like, you're perfect. Yep. That's the guy that we want.
I would like to be in your band.
He's not cynical yet. You know?
Yeah, so that was great. Somebody not tied down with no obligations or anything. That's Molehill material right there.
We should see if we have that email, if that's still in
probably,
Gmail.
I think I'm
it's in the cloud somewhere.
I'm terrible at deleting emails, so it probably is around somewhere.
We can post it on the WGN Facebook page later.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, Rick?
Yeah. And then Devin came around. He's the drummer who is unfortunately not here right now, but he that was, again, he played in another band that we knew called Nyko, and he was their drummer, and Trevor's, one of his bass professors, actually played bass in that band. And Trevor approached Devin one time to join with us, too. And, yeah, we've been together now solid, I think we're starting year 7, or did we just finish year 7? We've been together since early 2010.
Yeah.
How many states have you toured through?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. I
have to go home and do the math.
Because I know that you've done a lot of legwork. Literally, legwork.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of traveling.
We've been as far west as Omaha. Like, so Omaha to New York City and back many, many times.
As far north as Toronto and as far south as
Austin. Yeah.
So you make whatever geometric shape that makes.
Yeah. Well,
whatever's inside there.
I think it's a rhombus.
Yeah, it's a rhombus.
Could be.
Trapezoid. What?
All right. There you have it.
Or an oblong, rather. An oblong is a better shape. What? It just escaped me. But when, upon first listening to those first couple of measures in that song that we came in with, I always get chills, and I just got chills again. And I haven't listened to that song in a little while either. So,
thank you.
So that brings it back. How do you write your music, and how do you think of the lyrics and the melodies and the sounds? How do they come to you?
I feel like I could speak for about 2 hours on that. So I need to give a condensed version. We've been sort of streamlining our music writing process this whole time that we've known each other. So the music is sort of collaborative. Any one of us four will come up with ideas, arrange them on our computer or whatever, or even record them on my iPhone or something like that, and then we'll upload them. We have a folder we share, and then usually we'll just have this like giant folder of song ideas that I'll go through and see what I can add vocal melodies to. And I don't know, sometimes something just comes automatically. Sometimes I'll sit and do a little exercise trying to figure out what notes would go best in the different chord changes that we're going through, and kind of think of it almost more like I were composing like a piano piece or something like that. But as far as the lyrics, Yeah, it's from a whole lot of different places. Usually it's stories that I've heard or I read a lot. I really like reading novels, so I sometimes something in a novel will inspire me, but a lot of it's just stories that have either happened to me or other people in the band or just friends of ours or family or anything. Anything that sort of evokes this really strong emotional response or just moments of somebody's life that was very sort of pure and emotional. Those are kind of the things that are best for songs. Because even if it's about a specific person, when you have this strong emotional moment, that's something that, the whole world can relate to.
Absolutely. Well, I think we can preview or give a better glimpse of their music and those messages in the next segment. Rick, what do you think? Should we take a break?
I think you're a genius as a host, and I think, and I think these guys, though you're not talking too much, are very thoughtful for musicians, man. Seriously.
Oh, yeah,
seriously.
I know.
Because it's hard to articulate the process, man. I've always felt it's hard to articulate the process.
Yeah. Sometimes it's blind luck, really, too.
Yeah, I mean, just no kidding. No question.
Humming to yourself.
All right, well, should we take a break then?
If that's what you'd like to do, Alex.
I'm not a pro at this, you are.
Oh, no.
How do you throw it through a break?
We got to have a commercial now. Hi, you're listening to After Hours, but this is, I'm Rick Hogan, but I'm not really here. Elif Garris has taken over the radio station. Elif left the show a couple weeks ago to produce John Williams' show, but she introduced me to the band called Mole Hill, and you can look up there and listen to their music at molehillmusic.com, and I said, Elif, bring them in, man. You found them. Talk to them. And they're nice young musicians.
Yeah, I agree. Very nice.
We think that you guys are nice.
And smart, too. Well, no, and smart and thoughtful, too. You guys are pretty introspective in the short time we've had.
Thank you.
I agree. Nice. One of the questions that I was going to ask you earlier was, what's your favorite city to perform in?
Chicago, Illinois.
Oh, okay. I can guess
why. Boosterism.
I can guess why that is, but I won't put any words in your mouth. Why is that?
No, just I think we always get up for a Chicago show. We always draw really well. We've got a lot of good friends and family and fans who've supported us over the years, and every Chicago show is always a new great thing that we make unique every time. So I enjoy doing it.
So what's your favorite aspect then, other than having people you know there, of being in a Chicago venue?
Every live show is different that we do. We always try and do maybe something different instrumentally, like a new interlude that we've never done live before, or we like to work up a new cover that we think is really fun to do, surprise our fans with that.
You did do a,
Bowie.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. David Bowie. You did a Space Odyssey by David Bowie at Martyrs when I saw you guys the first time, and wow, it was really good. Do you like David Bowie, Rick?
Love David Bowie.
Good. Yeah, and they did such a good job of showcasing his work. So that's really impressive. And you were talking about how you make your music, and I guess it would be good to, before we dive in more into the next 6 minutes, to bring out a song of yours and let our listeners check it out. What do you think?
Yeah, sounds good.
It's a great idea. These guys are really good.
Can you just maybe... Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just commenting.
Critic. Give us a really, really short, brief glimpse of what this song is about or what it is.
It's called Hearts on Fire. It is our most recent single that we just released a couple weeks ago. We have a brand new music video for it out on YouTube as well.
Cool.
And it was inspired by the Euromaidan protests and subsequent revolution in Ukraine in late 2013, early 2014.
All right. Well, I think our listeners are probably ready. Go ahead.
I think you're back.
Hello. So
it's like a high and buy thing. You guys really, Ella, thank you so much for introducing these characters into my life. They're a really good band.
Thank you so much.
They're all so nice too, right?
Something's got to be screwed up here because they're nice and smart and a good band. Something's wrong. They've got to have some kind of, you're young, but you will learn that people like this have dark sides.
That's what we exercise on stage. We exercise the dark side.
So really quickly before we go, molehillmusic.com is the website. Listeners can go there to find out more about your group and to find more of your music and to see the full album. Albums. Your next show is going to be in Chicago where and when?
We're going to be playing at Martyrs on June 3rd. And the cool thing about this show, we have this special light setup we're using for this. Like the whole venue is going to be in black light.
Oh, wow.
And we'll be like posting more details about it and like what you should wear and some other things we'll be providing. It's going to be a really cool experience.
Why did you decide on black light?
This is actually another band called Model Stranger that invited us to play this. They did this last year.
Okay.
And it turned out really well, so we feel fortunate that our buddies invited us to do the show. It's going to be a good time.
It sounds like it's going to be awesome, and that's 4 days before my birthday, so that'll be a fun way to ring it in.
Cool.
Perfect.
Okay, so Two Souls is one of my favorite songs, and we were briefly talking about it earlier because producer Tom brought us back with that. We do have to break in about 10 seconds. So just what's your one thing that you want to say about Two Souls?
This song is classic Molehill, where we got this really simple melody and then we couldn't just stop there and we dressed it up with everything we could. Big string section, huge choruses. We sometimes don't know what to do with ourselves, so we just throw the whole kitchen sink production at it.
Awesome. LF Garris, you will one day take over this entire station.
Okay.
That would be my dream. You were great. You were great. And thank you for introducing Molehill to me. And you look for a story about these guys, because that's what I really do, is write for the Chicago Tribune. It's a pleasure to listen to you, and even a bigger pleasure to meet you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This fourth guy's
got to
be the dark side of the whole band.
He's so...
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, something's got to be really wrong with him. A heroin addict or something. LF, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and for having them as well.
Great pleasure. We got to get a commercial, then we'll say goodnight. Tom Hush, thanks for producing. Aubrey Mumpower, thanks for engineering. Carl Amari, thanks for having a show in a few minutes. And you, all of you, thanks a lot for listening. And LF Garris, too, for coming in and conducting an interview. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.